The news of our national politics today is a tale of two stories written in a single book titled Ungoverning, the Attack on the Administrative State and the Politics of Chaos. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. Your questions or comments are welcome by email at jx@jeffnet.org. My guest today is Russell Muirhead, co-author with Nancy Rosenblum of the book Ungoverning, the Attack on the Administrative State and the Politics of Chaos. Welcome to the Exchange, Russell.
Oh, thank you so much. Delighted to be here.
Well, let's start here. You write, quote, "Behind governing in the United States is a tale of two conflicts intertwined," end quote. Let's start there. Russell, what are the two conflicts?
Yeah, I'll tell you, I'm laughing because I feel like I'm getting examined on the book that I wrote. And I'm not sure I'm going to pass. But I'll tell you something. One is a conflict about the nature of presidential power, and it's about whether presidential power consists in authorities that are limited and attached to an office that different people inhabit over time, or whether presidential power is essentially about the will, the personal will of the president. The unbounded and undisciplined and unlimited will of the president. And that's, I think, I if I just kind of highlight one, that's the one that I'd point to first.
Well, you write about the second part. That is a good point. The first part is the enforcement of personal will. But here's what you write about the second part in Ungoverning. Here's the quote. "Restoration of America as a Christian nation, a white nation, a nation that subordinates women, a sovereign nation divorced from the New World Order," end quote. Does that statement of restoration imply that America was originally established as a white Christian nation by white nationalists?
Yeah, isn't it amazing that this idea, this sort of, you're right, like in part, this project of restoration is based on an imagined past, on a fantasy. A fantasy of what America once was about, but in truth, the carriers of that idea of America as a white Christian nation, were defeated, and they were defeated by Abraham Lincoln in the Civil War, but they were defeated in the 1780s by the founders of the Constitution, who didn't believe that. But I'll tell you, there have always been, whether you look back to the 1700s or the 1800s. Carriers of that ideal of the United States as a whites-only project, of a project that's fundamentally about privileging men. And so that's always had advocates. It is there in the past, even if it's been contested and defeated. And it hasn't gone away. And I think that's right. The idea is that the liberation of the president's personal power will help bring about this kind of a restoration of an imagined past. And I think you're getting, I think it's really astute that you're directing us to that sentence and to that idea in the book.
Well, today we have in our Congress and in state legislatures, elected leaders who are professing white nationalists, and many say openly that they are proud white Christian nationalists. Many say that they are original constitutionalists. And so this imagined past that you speak of, that you write of, is present in our politics today. Is that what is meant by those who say they want their country back?
I think you're right. I think the idea of taking our country back contains in it a kind of angry and violent exclusion of tens of millions of people who are also here in this country, and who are in fact a majority. And it is, I have to say, it's been an amazing trip over the last 10 years to see this racist nationalist ideal come out of the closet. I would have thought when I was younger, I would have thought that it had gone away, that it had died out with the older generations that carried it, and that it was no longer going to be part of our politics or our future. But you're absolutely right. Here it is, and that's I think what's alarmed Nancy and me, and what one of the things that motivated us to write this book.
Well, I guess that's our inheritance. It's been passed down. It hasn't been resolved. In your opening preface, you quote Steve Bannon saying, quote, "I want to bring everything crashing down," end quote. And you proclaim him to be a master of chaos. Is that hyperbole, or is he truly exercising a masterful strategy?
I think there is a way in which that message, bring it all crashing down, we're going to, whatever the metaphor, drain the swamp. We're going to attack the administrative state. We're going to, disable the agencies of government. We're going to eradicate agencies. We can't even remember, as Rick Perry said when he was running for president, we can't even remember which agencies we're going to eradicate, but we're going to eradicate them. This is actually a very seductive message for Americans who feel disempowered, who feel like their government's been captured by elites, that their government's decisions have been distorted by moneyed interests. And so I think there is a kind of mastery there, a skillfulness, a kind of very dangerous demagoguery to saying, look, the only way to fix it is to burn it all down.
I remember when former Texas Governor Rick Perry was famously quoted saying, oops, when he couldn't remember how many of the institutions of governing they wanted to eradicate. But that still persists today. So what do you believe is motivating people like Steve Bannon and tens of millions of others who believe as he does?
Well, I think that, one of the key motivations is that the reactionary right in the United States has actually been very unsuccessful at persuading Americans to agree with their aims, with their aspirations, with their project, with their project of restoration. And they're frustrated and they're angry. And I think that they've created a kind of fable about that explains to themselves why they failed. And the fable says, in those agencies, in those bureaus, in those departments of the federal government, liberals have installed themselves, globalists have installed themselves, and there they are, secretly, namelessly exercising power, machinating to defeat us and frustrate us. And so the only way to remove them from these invisible locations of power is to destroy the institutions that govern. And so I think it's born out of basically failure in the democratic process to persuade fellow citizens.
I'm talking with Russell Muirhead, co-author of the book Ungoverning, The Attack on the Administrative State and the Politics of Chaos. We welcome your questions or comments by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Russell, you write that former President Trump formed the very first presidential administration that was anti-administration. What do you mean?
I think that any, in my lifetime at any rate, the great rival parties and rival candidates have always posed, rival programs of government. And, Reagan, he wanted small government. He's the one who said government is the problem, but he also wanted a military that could stand up to the Soviet Union. And he wanted a larger defense department. He didn't in a wholesale way want to incapacitate every institution of government. And so I think the exchange of a kind of positive program of a case of, for what we can do if we're empowered, even if, if you're conservative and you say we're going to do it through deregulation, or if you're liberal and you say we're going to do it by creating a new program, that those rival accounts of what government can do have given way to a party that says, we're not going to do, we're going to destroy. And so it's an anti-administration. And, you know, I say it's the first one. We write that it's the first one. I think, you know, there are two other moments in American history where you might locate something like this. One is Jefferson, who comes in 1800, and he's opposed to the Federalists and the Federalist administration. But Jefferson runs an administrative state that does things. For instance, completes the Louisiana Purchase. And the other would be Andrew Jackson, who also was a sort of small government populist in you know, the 1820s. But Jackson, too, wanted a government that worked for ordinary people. He thought the government had been captured by elites, but he wanted a government that worked. I think what we're looking at now is the promise of a government that doesn't work. There's something very weird, very new. I'd almost say unprecedented.
Well, another point that stood out in your introduction in the book is the foundation of what you call good administration, which you attribute to Alexander Hamilton and the Federalist Papers. What did Hamilton want?
You know, Hamilton had this idea that the new national government would serve goals so broad, so widely shared, that everybody would appreciate its results. And when I say goals like that, what I mean are prosperity, widespread, sustained prosperity, peace and security from foreign invasion. Who isn't for peace? Those are these broad goals, freedom. And he thought that those goals could be best secured through good administration, which meant a government that collected data, that gathered information systematically, and that then with that data applied resources, powerful resources, to serve long-term goals, not goals that would, you know, only, you know, like be not sugar highs that would excite people and cause them to vote a certain way in the next, you know, 6 months, but long-term goals. And that's what he hoped. The national government, in contrast to the states, would be distinctively able to do. That's the idea of good administration. It's baked into our Constitution.
Well, you also refer to Hamilton as a, quote, great nationalist, end quote. And you introduce James Wilson as another, quote, great nationalist, end quote, at the 1787 Constitutional Convention. Now, these great nationalists, and these are white men, so these are great white nationalists that you refer to. What did James Wilson want?
The distinctive thing, I think, about both Hamilton and Wilson is they wanted a radically inclusive nation. Now, of course, we know and we are struck by, and I think we can't help but be disheartened by the complete exclusion in that day of all blacks from political membership and all women from political membership. And yet, of course, people like Wilson and Hamilton were radically inclusive, not just for that moment, but I think also in the respect that they never made an argument that could be used or marshaled to exclude later blacks and women. All of the arguments they made would be used to create a much more radically inclusive republic. Now, what James Wilson, who's not as well known as, say, Hamilton, wanted was a real participatory democracy. He wanted the people that, you know, directly, for instance, elected senators and the president. No electoral college, no electing senators through the state legislatures, which was done up until the early decades of the 20th century. So he wanted a really much more radically democratic union.
I'm talking with Russell Muirhead, co-author of the book Ungoverning, The Attack on the Administrative State and the Politics of Chaos. We welcome your questions and comments by email at jx@jeffnet.org. Russell, just before the break, we were talking about Alexander Hamilton and James Wilson, and I don't want to disparage these men in any way, but I also don't want to whitewash the reality. And the reality is that 13 colonies on a sliver of coastline on the Atlantic coast did not include the natives in their new nation. And there were many other nations, more than 500, really, on this continent at the time that they formed theirs. And they didn't include black people as equal to white people, and black people weren't citizens of the entire United States as well. So when you speak of radically inclusive, I'm confused.
Yeah, so some of what I'm referring to is the logic of their political ideals. When I think about especially someone like James Wilson, I think of someone, first of all, for his moment, who was radically inclusive in terms of his idea of democracy. And more so than others who shared his desire to create a new national government like Madison. And I also think that that later Americans took the logic of their arguments and used that logic to make the country more democratic and make the people more of a people by including ever more number of previously excluded people in the promise of American life. So I think that's, you're putting your finger on the core question about the American Constitution. There are those who, like William Lloyd Garrison, saw it as a pact with the devil, as a fundamentally, compromise with evil. And that evil being fundamentally slavery, but also corollary evils, exclusion of Native Americans and women. There are others like Frederick Douglass who saw the Constitution as what he called a liberty document, the logic of which would put those unjust exclusions under increasingly severe pressure as that logic became more persuasive to more people over time. So that's a fundamental kind of historical question about what the Constitution was. And I think you've got your finger right on it.
Well, it seems we're still struggling with that. We talked earlier about the nation being founded by white nationalists forming their own nation. What's the difference between what white nationalists who formed this nation wanted then versus what white nationalists want today?
Yeah, I think that's the question that's not just historical. What was the Constitution? Was it what Garrison wanted or thought or what Frederick Douglass thought? But what is it? What are we going to make it in our time now? And that's where the action is. And I think it's open. It's I think that we're much more risk looking ahead than many people believe. And I think that the specter of something much more exclusionary, more violent and more dark is real.
Well, talk about the meaning of federalism. You define it in two ways, classic and partisan. And you refer to James Madison's writings in Federalist Number 10.
In classic federalism, the states are really considered almost like separate political communities that pursue that can really stand up to the national government and check it when they think it's pursuing a course of action that's unjust. What that has sort of given way to in our time is a more partisan federalism where the national parties, the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, define the states just like they define the different groups in national politics. And in the states that are Republican trifectas, where Republicans rule both houses of the legislature and the governorship, what you see is a state that agrees completely with the National Republican Party and carries out its projects, and vice versa for trifecta Democratic states. And so rather than states being each their own distinctive political communities that might at times, become resources in a fight against or a struggle against a federal law that's unfair or unjust, now I think we see states as almost instruments of the parties.
So tell me, what is the Administrative Procedure Act?
Yeah, that is this. It's 1946, and this is after FDR is elected to the presidency. Of course, what he does is he really, I would argue, creates the modern administrative state the federal government that consists of all these agencies and bureaus and departments that are in charge with implementing the laws and programs that define, say, the New Deal, and are going to try to make the federal government work for the people in a new and more emphatic way. And these, you know, bureaucracies grow, and they have a kind of, you know, enormous power, and they're viewed with great suspicion and great skepticism. Where do they fit in the Constitution? You know, you have the Constitution. Article 1 is the legislature. Article 2 is the presidency. Article 3 is the judiciary. Where is this other thing? The 1946 Administrative Procedure Act was an attempt to describe what this administrative state would be and subject it to the rule of law so that it would be limited and its actions could be appealed. And you know, I think of it as almost the constitution of the administrative state.
I'm talking with Russell Muirhead, co-author of the book Ungoverning, The Attack on the Administrative State and the Politics of Chaos. Your questions or comments by email are welcome at jx@jeffnet.org. So this administrative state that some critics are calling a state of socialism, they're demonizing it in ways that allow them to criticize it and want to bring it down. Tell me this. What's the difference between governing and imposing one's personal will by leveraging the power of the administrative state? Haven't previous presidents done that?
Yeah, I mean, to govern is, first of all, to start with a law and a policy and a goal that's both, you know, written and durable, and to try to make that law actual, make it real, by implementing it, by writing regulations that bring it into being and allow it to have an effect in the real world. That's a governing process, and it, as opposed to an individual president who says, you know, this will be done. My generals will arrest these people. You know, as if the generals or the Department of Defense are the instrument of the personal will of the president, or as if the lawyers and the attorney general in the Justice Department are there to serve the personal vendettas of the president. And so the difference between an administrative state that makes laws real and an administrative state that carries out the whims and the will of an individual person is the difference between, you know, a limited government of laws and something much more autocratic, authoritarian.
Well, you also write that civil servants today are being personally excoriated, fired, made targets of threats and violence. So how is this vitriol today any different from past generations that experienced covert and overt overthrows of local governments, takeovers of state governments by the Klan, and outright assassinations of political leaders? Hasn't the political nature of our nation always been steeped in violence? And isn't that the inheritance that we must now reconcile?
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that there's a legacy of rogue violence, mob violence, the mob violence that you know attacked and killed abolitionists and abolitionist editors in the 1850s, that enforced racial segregation through lynching and mob action, you know, throughout the 20th century, and the kind of threats they made against election workers as part of a you know, grander enterprise to reverse the outcome of an election, or to impose one's will on the outcome of an election. I think that violence is not like it's just been discovered, but I think it's what we're seeing now is this specific orientation of threats of violence and sometimes violence against particular civil servants for the sake of, again, suspending the application and administration of law.
Well, you write that the objective of the Republican Party today and certain justices on the Supreme Court is to deconstruct the administrative state. How can they do that?
One way, I mean, they, you know, the political branches, what we're seeing is this kind of errant effort to destruct it, to destroy it. You know, if I'm elected, I will eliminate this agency. I will take out, I will incapacitate the IRS, is one sort of promise that we hear consistently. But from the judges, it's much, much more calibrated and restrained, and it has to do with specific precedents, like the Chevron precedent, that allowed agencies to interpret regulations when Congress's instructions were somewhat vague. And this attack is much more calibrated, much more specific, and I think, you know, could be ultimately even more debilitating than the much more kind of chaotic attack coming from political candidates.
So if the ungoverning forces succeed, what replaces the administrative state?
I think that is, you know, I think that it's really, you know, when I look at the annals of political history, hard to find a precedent for this kind of destruction. So where we could say, yeah, this is what will happen. The best precedent I can see is something like Venezuela, where the state is a state and the administrative state is destroyed and is replaced by loyalists to Chavez, loyalists to Maduro, and what we have are, you know, is rule of thugs in a once prosperous country that's now been made barely inhabitable, and I think, you know, that's actually where ungoverning points.
Well, you tell us that ordinary citizens can rehabilitate the administrative state. How?
You know, I think one thing is to recognize, I mean, it's so invisible. It's not really part of civics education. The, you know, what actually constitutes our government is something that we don't really teach children about, and that we're not really habituated to value. And I think, you know, the beginning is to just appreciate that there are so many conscientious, really skillful, very expert people who are undertaking the daily work of government and who need to be seen and appreciated. We can't take this for granted anymore.
Well, you argue that we need broad public endorsement of the meaning, the value, and the authority of the administrative state. But if the desire by more than half of white American voters is to revert the nation back to a previous condition of white nationalism, as evidenced by consistent voting data in nearly every presidential election, then whose responsibility is it to save democracy from these forces of ungoverning?
I mean, you know, the I do think that the real, you know, in the background in American politics has been the inability of either of our great parties to create a governing coalition that endures, that's diverse enough and broad enough, capacious enough to endure for more than a couple of years. When the Democrats get complete control of the House, Senate, the presidency, they tend to lose it in 2 years, as they did under Clinton, as they did under Obama, as they did under Biden. Of course, the Republicans are also, I think they've given up on the idea of creating a really broad, capacious, diverse coalition, and are more committed to, you know, strategies of disenfranchisement and minority rule. But I think to really re-legitimate the government is going to require, you know, creating the kind of coalition that Roosevelt succeeded in creating, that Lincoln did to an extent, that Jackson did, and that Jefferson did, but that very few others in history have succeeded at doing.
Well, what's your recommendation?
And my recommendation to the creative political people who are really trying to build coalitions, whether in movements or in electoral politics, my recommendation is, of course, to articulate and be true to the core values of your own side, but also to look to the other side and ask yourself, what do they know that we don't always remember so well?
Can
we take something from them to enlarge and deepen our own coalition.
We have to leave it there. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.